I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. General David Petraeus and U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker returned to Capitol Hill today. Members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, three of whom are Democratic presidential candidates, pressed the general and ambassador on questions left unanswered from their testimony before the House yesterday. Questions such as, is there a post-surge strategy? And questioners included prominent Republicans. Ranking Republican Richard Lugar said he remains deeply skeptical of the U.S. war strategy, which he compared to a farmer risking his savings to plant on a floodplain.
Even as the administration defines its current strategy, it's vital that it plan for a range of post-September contingencies. The surge must not be an excuse for failing to prepare for the next phase of our involvement, whether that is a partial withdrawal, a gradual redeployment, or some other option.
Joining us now, Gail Chad, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, following this all. And Gail, yesterday Republicans in the House largely supportive of the war plan, critical of critics of the war plan. Your thoughts on Republicans today?
Well, it's a difference between a room with 100 House members and a room with 18 senators. If you put a label over party identification, at least for the first four or five rounds of questioning, I think you'd be hard-pressed to guess who was a Republican and who was a Democrat. And I think Lugar is an excellent example of that. Mm. He said, we really need to ask deeper questions than is there progress? Is the administration, he said, finally defining, finally being a very important word for a Republican, finally defining a clear political military strategy, planning for follow-up contingencies, and engaging in robust regional diplomacy. That, I think, is the new fault line of the debate when Congress gets back to this issue and the general leaves.
Not whether or not it worked, you know, over the summer, but what's ahead. Well, Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel, an early critic of the war, who just recently announced he's not going to seek re-election or run for president, spoke today about how the U.S. appears to have lost southern Iraq. We just want to listen to a few seconds because he seemed to be at wit's end for what's next. Let's listen.
Are we going to continue to invest American blood and treasure at the same rate we are doing now? For what? The president said, let's buy time. Buy time? For what? Every report I've seen, and I assume both of you agree with this, there's been really very little, if any, political process that is the ultimate core issue, political reconciliation in Iraq.
Gail, how did either the general or the ambassador respond to that?
That line of question, I think, led to the most promising discussion in all the hearings so far, where General Petraeus said, look, we are in neighborhoods sitting on sectarian fault lines, but there are fundamental changes that are happening on the ground, not at the national level yet. He said there the laws that we're looking for, the oil law, the amnesty, political reconciliation, these have not happened, but they are happening on the ground. He said, look, Iraq is already sharing oil revenues. There's more budget going to Sunni Arab regions. There is no general amnesty law, but Sunnis are graduating from the police academy next month. So the things that cannot be done at the national level are somehow happening at a local level.
But was anything said, though, about a post-surge strategy? Yesterday, the general saying that the surge troops, about 30,000, could come home by next summer. But then what?
Well, that is, of course, another great point. Both Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus said, we can't see beyond the summer. They had a very elegant chart that showed steps leading downward that went from leading role for U.S. forces to a partnering role to tactical overwatch to operational overwatch to strategic overwatch. They went from, for those with black and white televisions, from red and orange leading and partnering to cool blue and green colors for strategic overwatch and exit, but no timeline whatsoever on that chart beyond, you know, the removal of 5,000 troops by December. The first exit had already been planned. So very little satisfaction in terms of what's next.
Well, here's an exchange between committee chair and presidential candidate Joseph Biden. It's become clear to many of these presidential candidates that one of them might be overseeing the war. He pressed Ambassador Crocker on his statements that success in Iraq will not be quick, and he also, Biden, wanted to know how long it will take.
If, in fact, the circumstances of the ground are exactly what they are today, in March of next year, will you recommend the continuation of somewhere between 130 and 160,000 American troops being shot at, killed, and maimed every day there?
Mr. Chairman, it's a pretty big hypothetical.
Well, I don't think it's hypothetical. If they're the same.
I would be very hard-pressed to recommend that at that point in time.
Well, I would pray you'd be wise enough not to recommend it and start to listen to General Jones and others who talk about a fundamental redeployment of our force, a fundamental change in our footprint in the region, and a fundamental alteration of our objective in moving toward a federal system.
Biden referring there to General James Jones, who ran the Independent Commission, whose pretty scathing report came out a couple of weeks ago. What was the response to that idea of change?
Well, I think Petraeus's comment, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to recommend the same. I mean, that they really are not saying anything beyond this initial drawdown and march. And this is where I think Congress actually has, for the first time, some bipartisan leverage. I'm very interested in what's happening on the House side right now. Neil Abercrombie from Hawaii, in the last time this House Armed Services Committee met, passed with unanimous Republican support a requirement that the president set out his withdrawal plans, his plan B, if you will, within 2 months. There is a lot of support for that on both sides of the aisle. And to my sense, that's what's beginning to come out of these hearings. Not so much a debate about the facts or this initial timeline, but kind of jumping ahead to the next stage.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And by the way, I think it was Ambassador Crocker you were referring to who said
I'm
he'd be hard-pressed. That's
exactly
quite all right.
Right.
That's quite all right.
Thank you.
Gail, thanks as always. Well, it's September 11th, 6 years after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington and a field in Pennsylvania. How are you feeling today? Here are the thoughts of some residents of Portland, Oregon.
I think as a result of 9/11, a lot of things have changed, and I'm always pretty frustrated when I fly, especially because it seems like they take all these precautions, but I don't feel any safer because of it, so that's kind of a frustrating thing.
You know, I almost feel like I should be feeling more. I don't know. You know, I'm at a loss for words. Honestly, I almost feel guilty for not feeling worse.
To be quite honest, I'm not sure what to make of it. It feels in a very distant past in some respects, but it's not at all clear if we've moved to somewhere else or if we're where we're sort of going to head to next. And a lot of time has passed, but we don't seem to have done much.
Of course, families of loved ones lost on 9/11 have no such ambivalence. In fact, some families are still burying their loved ones as remains are newly discovered. But for everyone else, it feels as if there's a spectrum of feelings 6 years after planes flew from Boston, Newark, and Washington through clear blue skies and into a field in Pennsylvania, the Pentagon in Washington, and the Twin Towers in Manhattan. Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, a noted liberal commentator. After 9/11, it became a news story that he hung out a flag. He was so noted as sort of a lefty. But when he visited with us, he said it felt like the logical response to wanting to show support for his fellow New Yorkers and Americans. So we've called Todd. And Todd, how are you feeling today?
Grave and resolved to live a good life and overcome the tragedies of the past. I say overcome them and not forget them, but also not wallow in them. And I think one of the moods I hear is that there's become something ritualistically over-rehearsed about our commemorations. I share that feeling.
You're hearing them say that, and we know, in fact, there have been reports that there was much debate among New Yorkers. How much do we do? Do we say the names again? And there was a big split on that. Tell us more about that.
You know, I think what many people feel is that the recital of the names is justified, but many people have latched on to the anniversary, which is understandable, with particular interpretations that make the awful events of September 11, 2001 usable for their purposes. You know, this is not surprising in a culture like ours, which is awkward about remembering suffering. We're the famously the uplift people, we're prone to the ritualistic reminders of past events, but we don't really know what to do with them. I mean, take Memorial Day. I mean, how many people actually spend Memorial Day remembering the war dead? Veterans Day, I remember from my childhood, is a commemoration of the exact day of the armistice of World War I. But, of course, the anniversary has floated off into a kind of Empyrean realm of vagueness.
Well, that's
attachment to any particular occasion.
Well, that's almost 100 years on, and some would say, I mean, we're hearing about this debate in New York that some feel that people are holding on to the full commemoration too long. But, you know, this is a fresh wound for so many New Yorkers.
When I say that New Yorkers, I think, are weary of the formalities of the commemoration, many of them anyway, I don't mean to say that they've forgotten. I don't think for a moment the attacks are forgotten. And I don't mean just by the families, who, of course, never forget their private losses. I mean, you know, you look at the skyline and from Brooklyn or in the lower end of Manhattan, and you see the gaping absences. You know, you keep feeling for the missing tooth.
You know, how would you characterize it? I mean, you, as you wrote in your book, Intellectuals and the Flag, you were breathing in this day. You were one of the New Yorkers that was,
yeah,
you know, down, you know, near all of this happening. Do you find yourself forgetting at times and then suddenly remembering? How does it work?
This actually happened to me the other day. I happened to be in Lower Manhattan Saturday night. You look up at what used to be this space overreach or overhung by the enormity of the towers. The towers are no longer there, and I perceive the absence. Of course, the most grotesque after sense, if you let me coin that word, after September 11th is the hardest to remember. In fact, I would say it's impossible to remember. It was the smell. We don't have such a good olfactory memory. You know, that's gone and really unrecoverable, except, you know, some sort of, you know, words we have for it. It was acrid. This is ineradicable. The last New Yorker to be alive who will remember it will always remember, you know, the odor and the immensity of that experience. And then the experience of solidarity, the experience of people looking for their lost ones and the little memorials that sprang up all over the city. I mean, all this is very fresh. Even as I speak these words, I'm remembering walking down to the local hospital to give blood that day and discovering they didn't want any, i.e. there were no survivors. I mean, I think anybody who was anywhere nearby carries those wounds with him or her.
As social commentator Todd Gitlin, a New Yorker, a professor, speaking about memory and memorializing September 11th. And when we come back, more on that debate, how much to do on this day. And later in the program, the future vision of Ground Zero from an architect as he stands and surveys the work that's being done there. Back after a break, here and now. On this, the 6th anniversary of September 11th, how are you marking it? Here's a sampling from Boise, Idaho.
Me and my family are actually getting together, and we're going to have a nice dinner together and stuff because we had people in the tower. They were some of my mom's business associates, and they were close friends that we had dinner with. That's why we're having the dinner.
I wouldn't know what to do to mark the anniversary. I mean, anybody can take a moment of silence, or you can join a vigil or, you know, something like that. But I know that, like, on that day, I remember feeling like this is a level of compassion that's kind of hit me, and I hope it never leaves. Every time since then, I feel literally sorry for myself. There are times when I'll be complaining about something stupid, and I literally think about the people on the airplanes the second before they hit the towers and they knew what was going on. Or the people who were jumping from the towers, how they went from being at work 1 second to within moments being completely hopeless, and that their only recourse was just to dive, you know? So I definitely still feel I've never let go of that strain of just, man, you think you're having a bad day.
Voices from Boise, Idaho. Well, we're taking the pulse of New Yorkers now with one of them, Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University and a guest on the program before. And Todd, before the break, you were talking about how fresh the experience of 9/11 is for you. But there's also a debate about whether people should be reading the names of the victims today or not. Given how present you say these feelings are, how can this not be marked in this formal way?
Yes, I do believe there ought to be some public commemoration, but I don't know that it needs to be, the cavalcade of stars, you'll pardon me, which has become routine. There was an interesting ceremony, it was either 02 or 03, where people who were not celebrities collected together on the Jersey side and had a ceremony which was not the telethon. You know, that struck me as an authentic remembrance on the part of people who shared in the experience, not by dying, but by being connected to this moment of mass murder. Something fresh and something that would remind people that this was a collective event that took place among human beings and not something that belongs to garish remembrance.
In fact, that collective event taking place among human beings is in a way, you told us, your definition of patriotism. You said it was sharing a common life experience, and we mentioned that you'd put up the flag after 9/11, and a reporter saw that, and so this was a big deal. Hey, you know, liberal icon puts up flag, and you objected to that because you said, well, I'm not ceding my patriotism to others. You also told us that you took the flag down eventually because you felt patriotism was sort of seeping into nationalism, you know, wanting to impose a love of country on someone else, and so you took it down. Do you put the flag up again on the anniversary?
No, I actually don't like automatic ritual. I like to have a fresh relation to reality, and you know, my memorials are mostly in my head.
So again, what's in your head today? What are you doing to memorialize this day?
I have some photos that were taken in the late 90s by a marvelous photographer named Celia Shapiro. She took photos of people in the plaza of the World Trade Center for years, people who were themselves trying to get a grip on the strange enormity of those towers.
This is way before they came down. This is
people
this looking
is
at them.
In the 90s. Yes, these were tourists largely. And I have three of them hanging out in the hall here. And I will mark the day by meditating on those images of people living among the towers. And I say this as somebody, this is a very common experience in New York, although it's probably some people would consider it unseemly to talk about. Many New Yorkers, and I was one of them, did not like the towers, thought they were out of scale. They clashed with the neighborhood. They were architecturally undistinguished, and they were forbidding. And what's moving to me about these photos of people taking photos of the towers is that we see them with their cameras trying to collect a sense of the towers, to put the towers in a kind of mental space, a kind of visual space that made sense to them and that they could get a grip on. And I like that image of people facing enormity in their human ways, which are various. And I will meditate on something that I can't quite easily formulate at the moment, but that's my connection to the towers.
Well, it strikes me that now we watch people facing enormity in a very different way. They're looking at where the towers were, and it's almost more enormous, you know, trying to.
Well, yes, I mean, you get used to buildings, and then, you know, sort of when a building which was a site and then becomes a building then returns to the site, then it's this, you know, it's this gaping absence, as I was saying before. And, you know, this is an immensity. And I think it's worth staring at. I think it's worth beholding without any question.
Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, author of many books. His upcoming is The Bulldozer and the Big Tent, Blind Republicans, Lame Democrats, and the Recovery of American Ideals. Todd, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we go into the news, we'll leave with some more thoughts on marking September 11th. These from the streets of Boston.
In some ways, our reaction to it has been as bad as the actual event. I don't think we're any more secure. I think we're just more on alert.
It's still very present in my mind. It's ever present in my mind. I'll think about it, but I'll live my life because that's what I have to do.
With the recent Bin Laden tape, I don't know, I'm apprehensive, I'm a little nervous about another attack. I'm not thinking back. I'm thinking ahead to the next 48 hours, holding my breath.
I'm trying to forget about it.
My windows overlook the Boston Common, and I remember the day it happened, watching the military jets circle the skies, and I'll probably look up my window and be happy they're not there.
Some sadness, but also solace in that, you know, the country's moved on and we're still united and strong and we can come back from pretty much anything.
Still ahead, we'll go to Ground Zero, the subject of tears, angry debate, new buildings, in other words, quintessential New York. That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
Gregory Allen Clark.
Manny Leroy Clark.
Thomas.
Relatives of World Trade Center victims gathered today, as they have each September 11 since 2001. But today, for the first time, they met in a small park to listen as the names of the dead were read. They moved from Ground Zero because of construction. Construction equipment now fills the vast city block where the World Trade Center once stood. Family members wanted only memorial space, but after 6 years of wrenching debate, workers are pouring concrete and raising steel. The $16 billion project, based on the master plan of architect Daniel Libeskind, now includes a train station, a memorial and museum, and four new towers, including the Freedom Tower, to be completed by 2013. We asked architecture critic Philip Noble to give us his view. He's the author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero. He went to the site earlier for us, and we asked him to tell us what he saw.
What it looks like now is a construction site. I mean, finally, after years of stasis, there's construction reaching above the level of the 70-foot deep pit that the foundations were in.
I remember being at the site at one of the anniversaries, and all of the survivors, the families of those who died in the buildings, descended down into that deep. It was almost like an empty swimming pool pit.
Yeah, they call it the bathtub.
Well, many of us have not been privy to the entire debate. What is going to be built there?
What's going to be built is something that will look familiar to all Americans. It's sort of a corporate office park with the Freedom Tower and, you know, obviously a building of extraordinary height, but then some three or four fairly mundane-looking office buildings that wouldn't be out of place in Houston.
Well, I'm taking from your language, what? Do you not think it's worthy of the site? I mean, mundane, that's certainly not what most of America would want there.
That was the tension all through the rebuilding debate. I mean, everybody wanted something special, and my stance has always been that New York building culture, when you have large amounts of land and money at stake, is almost incapable of moving past the bottom line. So all of the architects rallied, and amateur designers from all over the country sent their ideas to politicians, and there was this sort of open bazaar of visions of what should happen here. But it surprises no one locally that it's turned out otherwise.
Well, and who won? Tell us about the architect and the builder.
Who won, actually, are the local residents. In the fight to determine what would be built here, they had a wish list, which is basically, bring back what was here, plus some culture, plus some park. They got all of that. The families originally were claiming the entire 16-acre mega block as a sacred precinct, and that got whittled down now to, a museum and a memorial that comprises about 2 acres. But in terms of who won the architecture competition, Daniel Libeskind was awarded the job of master planner, or master plan architect was his formal title, which didn't entitle him to design any particular buildings. It was more of a land use study and the disposition of where the buildings would go on the site and what elements would be included and where they would go. And he presented this very avant-garde vision in 2003, which was just steadily eroded for the better. It was sort of improved by input from everyone, politicians to people on the street. And what stands now is a plan that was always the only possible plan, which was to rebuild the 10 million square feet of office space, make a nod towards the memorial, and then get the trains running again.
Do you think New Yorkers will flock to this area, or will there be a superstition about getting out of a train at this area?
Yeah, I thought for years that there would be a stigma attached to it, but where I'm standing now, there's a steady stream of people going in and out of a popular discount department store that opened up not too long after the attacks, right across the street from the site. And I think partly because what will be built is so banal, and it, apart from the area reserved for the memorial, the perimeter of the site will be erased, so people may not even know they're on the site.
Philip, do you talk to the hard hats, the construction workers at all, the people working down there? Is there a sense of, what they're doing, or does this just feel like any other construction site in New York?
The only thing that sets it apart from other construction sites is you still see stickers on the helmets, the flags and sort of memorial stickers and images of the Twin Towers. And during the early years of the reconstruction, there was a particular hard hat that was covered with the Stars and Stripes, which was a very hot item, and you could see it sort of proliferating until a quarter of all the construction workers were wearing these flags on their heads. So I think there is a palpable sense that for the workers at least, it's a sight apart. But looking at it as a New Yorker, it looks like a giant hole in the ground.
Philip, you're speaking to us with sort of, I'm hearing some of the cool detachment of an architecture critic, but I'm seeing that, you thought you were sort of removed from the emotional aspect of the story. You thought that you were like the New Yorkers who said, well, I wasn't really there. I just, in your case, you watched it from a rooftop in Brooklyn. So you didn't really, as you write, grieve it until what? When did that coolness crack for you?
Sometime last year, I was sitting the first building to be the only building to be put back up on what was part of the original site is a building called 7 World Trade Center. I'm looking at it now across the construction site, and there was a lot of fuss about it because it's designed by Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, which is this big, faceless corporate firm, and it came out beautifully. It incorporates a couple of art pieces at the bottom, one of which scrolls the text of E.B. White's Here is New York, which is always mine and everyone's favorite, ode to New York City. And he writes beautifully and lovingly about the impossibility of New York sustaining itself. I would say it caught me completely off guard because I basically lived down here for 2 years following the story. And sometime last year, I was sitting in the park across the street watching my kids play, of course, and just burst into tears. It got to the heart of what I'd always felt about the site, which was that it was a good thing that New Yorkers responded with the kind of predictable greed and venality that they did. All of the politicians misbehaved at one time or another. All of the architects, overblew what they could actually achieve. All the families at different points made these outrageous demands. And in my sort of end-around reasoning, that was a positive thing because you don't want to see the attack on a city that changes its fundamental nature.
Architecture critic Philip Nobel at Ground Zero. He's the author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero. Well, here's an excerpt from E.B. White's Here is New York that so affected Philip. It was published in 1949 in the wake of the new atomic threat and oddly foreshadowed 9/11. White writes, "The city, for the first time in its long history, is destructible. A single flight of planes no bigger than a wedge of geese can quickly end this island fantasy, burn the towers, crumble the bridges, turn the underground passages into lethal chambers, cremate the millions. The intimidation of mortality is part of New York now, in the sounds of jets overhead and the black headlines of the latest editions." But White goes on to praise the newly built UN building and the peacemakers he hopes will protect New York. "This lofty target scraping the skies and meeting the destroying planes halfway, home of all people and nations, housing the deliberations by which the planes are to be stayed and their errand forestalled." Of course, they did not forestall 9/11, but he concludes New Yorkers don't crave comfort and convenience. If they did, they'd live somewhere else. You're listening to Here and Now. After 3 days of closing arguments, the jury is now deciding the fate of once legendary music producer Phil Spector. Spector was once hailed as the tycoon of teen. His wall of sound enveloped the Beatles, the Righteous Brothers, the Ronettes. He's now facing charges in connection with the murder of Lana Clarkson, a down-on-her-luck actress who was shot and killed at Spector's California home in 2003. LA Weekly staff writer Stephen Mikulin has been following the story in a series called Phil Noir. And Stephen, I'm just wondering, can you tell if Spector's legacy is having an impact on the jurors?
I would guess not, surprisingly. Phil Spector's career and his reputation have pretty much gone by the wayside in terms, I think, of most Americans. We tend not to really value the role of music producers, you know, whose last hits took place decades ago. He is very, very well regarded in the UK, however, and there's an enormous interest in the trial over there.
What about his famous eccentricities? He's been appearing in court in this huge head of graying hair.
You know, he comes to court every day wearing these Edwardian frocks. They're like teddy boy outfits, these very long jackets, these 4-inch heels on his shoes. And he has this sort of variety of wigs that his wife, Rochelle, very angrily tells us that they're not wigs, that they're his real hair.
Well, this speaks to, you know, this says something about the trial, given that he's on trial for murder and, you know, people are discussing his hair. And his wife has been much in the news. We understand before turning the case over to the jury, Judge Larry Paul Fidler questioned jurors about whether or not they'd heard comments allegedly made public by his wife, 27-year-old Rochelle. What was leaked and were jurors compromised?
You know, basically, last Friday, Judge Larry Paul Fidler warned, without naming Rochelle, her not to engage in any more interviews or conversations with the press. And yet, that very same afternoon, she had an interview with Court TV and then went on her website promoting it. And he was furious yesterday, and he called her out on it, and then she gave him a lot of lip back, and that made Fidler, who was a real stickler for decorum, it really upset him, and we thought he was going to have her ejected, but he pulled back at the last minute, and everyone calmed down.
Well, Spector is charged in the death of Lana Clarkson. He was there that night. His driver said that Spector stepped outside holding a gun and said, "I think I killed someone." What is Spector's defense?
His defense, oddly enough, is that his driver, a Brazilian national, had such little command of the English language that he possibly misunderstood Spector. Also, they harped on this a water fountain, running in the background in this courtyard, and they're making it sound like it was Niagara Falls and that the chauffeur, Adriano de Souza, couldn't possibly have made out these famous words of Spector, which was, "I think I killed somebody."
And how is the defense saying how she might have died if not shot
by
Spector?
They floated a number of theories, which is very strange. They never seem to settle on one unifying idea. One school of thought was that she was suicidal, that her career was in the toilet, and that she was just waiting for a rich man to pick her up, take her home so she could blow her brains out in his foyer. The other theory is that she had a history of playing with guns. She knew firearms from her film roles, and she was drunk and toying around with a gun in Spector's foyer, and it went off in her mouth somehow.
Steve Mikulin, he's been following the Phil Spector murder trial for the Los Angeles Weekly. Stephen, any idea how long the jury will deliberate?
My colleagues said it would be a slam dunk, that as soon as they chose the foreman, they would take an up-and-down vote, and we'd be out in time for lunch. That was yesterday, but they spent almost 4 hours deliberating. They come back today. My hunch is that it's going to go the greater part of the week, and I believe, it's just my opinion, that he's going to get a hung jury.
Well, we'll wait and see. Stephen Mikulin, reporter for the LA Weekly. Stephen, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
And from the wall of sound in a minute to the new old music from Charles Mingus. That's next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And that is the inimitable bass of Charles Mingus, brought to us today by James Isaacs, here in Now's Jazz Aficionado. The sound is from a new two-disc set recorded 43 years ago, but just released for the first time ever. It's the sound of an artist who occupies a unique place in the 100-year history of recorded jazz, actually, in all of American improvisational music. Let's hear another song.
One, two,
James, what a gift you've brought us today. What is the name of the number we're listening to?
Robin, the piece we're listening to is called Meditations, and this was the first time this extended work was ever recorded. The recording date was March 18, 1964. The place, Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and the band was probably the most brilliant small group Charles Mingus ever assembled. You had the cool trumpeter Johnny Coles. You had the hard bop to taking it out tenor player Clifford Jordan. The great and intrepid Eric Dolphy on bass clarinet, flute, and alto saxophone. There was the piano professor, Jackie Byard. And on drums, Mingus's alter ego, Danny Richmond.
Oh, and on bass.
Well, of course, you had Charles Mingus. And do not ever refer to him as Charlie, because as Mingus once said, Charlie is the name of a horse. Charles is the name of a man, and he meant it. The full title of this two-CD set is Charles Mingus Sextet with Eric Dolphy, Cornell, 1964.
And it's a big deal in the music world.
It really is.
Why is Mingus in this unique position in the history of jazz?
Well, Robin, because he was hands down the single foremost improvising bassist, band leader, and composer arranger who ever lived. And because his music, profoundly influenced by the Black Church, the blues, and by his idol Duke Ellington, displayed, I would say, more naked emotion and carried more emotional weight than just about anyone's. Incidentally, there are two tunes on this two-disc set associated with Duke Ellington: the maestro's Sophisticated Lady, which is one of the great beauties in all of American music, and Take the A-Train, Billy Strayhorn's theme for the Ellington Orchestra. Anyway, back to Mingus. He had an exceptionally vivid style in his music, and his music was a study in contradictions. It betrayed his various rages, but it was also as tender as the sighs of two people who've just fallen in love.
Well, that's poetry.
Yeah. Mingus's music was visceral, but it was also yearning. But above all, it was relentlessly impassioned.
Well, it was also at times overtly political. Tell us about
that. It was indeed. Let's listen now to one of Mingus's signature originals, Fables of Phoebus, dedicated, if that's the word, to the segregationist governor of Arkansas, who in 1957, well, he tried to block the integration of the Little Rock public schools. And if you listen closely while the caustic music plays, you'll hear him ask drummer Danny Richmond about the governor. Why is he so sick and ridiculous?
James, I said earlier that you brought us this music. You did bring us the CD, but it's by way of Sue Mingus.
Correct.
Tell us the story of why this release took so long.
Some years ago, the tapes were almost leased to Fantasy Records, but that didn't work out for whatever reason. Then the tapes were lost for a while, then they were found, then they were lost again, and then they were found again. Mm. At last, they were obtained by Blue Note from Mingus's widow. You just mentioned her name, Susan Graham Mingus. She administers all aspects of the Mingus musical estate. She's also been vigilant when it comes to protecting her late husband's music from bootleggers. From 1964 alone, there were, by my count, at least 14 Charles Mingus albums. Some are legit, some aren't. However, these two discs are a real find and the real thing.
Hmm. You've spoken about his anger at politics, how
absolutely.
His rage could come through his music, but give us an example of his gentler side.
Robin, one of Mingus's loveliest and most luxuriant melodies is called Orange Was the Color of Her Dress, Then Blue Silk. Johnny Cole's muted trumpet is in the lead, and listen also to Mingus's rapidly articulated accompaniment toward the end of this segment. Wow, Mingus.
James, you've told us that on this beautiful set, Eric Dolphy gets co-star billing. Tell us about him.
Eric Dolphy was one of the giants of the 1960s avant-garde jazz movement. Dolphy and Mingus went back as far as 1949 when they worked together occasionally in Los Angeles, where Dolphy was born in 1928. He moved to New York and rejoined Mingus in 1960 and was with him on and off until he, Dolphy, died in 1964, just 3 months after the Cornell concert. There's a blues on this collection called So Long, Eric, and it was titled as such because Dolphy had given Mingus his notice. He would make the spring European tour with the Mingus Sextet, then he'd be leaving to go solo. But on June 29th, 1964, Eric Dolphy suffered a fatal heart attack, so sadly, the title So Long, Eric has a double meaning. I read somewhere that when Dolphy was living in California, before moving to New York, he used to get up early and play his flute at dawn while the birds sang back to him. So I thought we'd close with a wonderful example of Dolphy's flute on Jitterbug Waltz. Now, this was, as far as I know, the only time Mingus played this Fats Waller classic.
Think of those birds.
Yeah. Robin, there are a couple of more things I want to say about this 2-CD set. First, well, it's about Mingus. He left this world and left us a world of music in 1979 when he was 56. He died of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
So young.
And second, on Cornell 1964, there's a terrific version, a swinging version of one of the most unlikely tunes one would ever associate with Charles Mingus, or for that matter, jazz musicians in general. It's When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. Do not miss Charles Mingus Sextet with Eric Dolphy, Cornell 1964.
Oh, well, on that recommendation. James, thanks as always.
Robin, my pleasure. Really my pleasure today.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.